You are listening to a digitally remastered class of HaRav Yochanan Zweig, Rosh HaYeshiva of the Talmudic University of Florida.
Now, Hanukkah is really the celebration of our victory over Western civilization that really infiltrated the Jewish people very seriously. There was the time, first of all, there was the Hellenists. Then there was the attack on, which was those Jews that started accepting Greek values. And then there was the Sadducim, which started questioning at the same time the ultimate authority of the rabbis. And Hanukkah really celebrates our victory over them. The fact that God used the Greeks as a stick to attack us, to challenge us to understand we had a problem, is because our own personal issues were issues of Western civilization. And every year, Shabbos Hanukkah always is Parshas Miketz. And I thought perhaps that there must be something in the Parsha itself that would be reflective of our victory over the Greeks. And I think there's a very, very important value here that has become to most of us such a healthy American value that we don't realize that it's really a Greek value and it's really the antithesis of the Torah. It's really become really part of our culture, and it's very, very hard for us to stand back and look objectively and to re-examine a very, very basic American value that is really a product of Western civilization, that it's really anti-Torah. Let's take a look at the Parsha, page 448. It was the end of 2 years, and Pharaoh had a dream, and he's standing on the Nile. And behold, from the river comes up 7 cows, Yefos Marah. Rashi translates as a beautiful appearance. The English translates, Ubrios Boser, healthy meat. Vatir Ener Ba'ochu, and they were grazing in a swamp. We take a look now at Rashi, a very fascinating Rashi here. Yefos Marah, the fascinating thing to me is that everybody who's ever learned this story and translated it, including Rabbi Artsko here, did not translate it according to Rashi. Let's take a look at Rashi. Yefos Marah, beautiful appearance. So we all translate that as meaning, if you looked at them, they looked extremely beautiful, Rashi. It is a sign, we may sova. It's for the days of sova, days of plenty, of abundance. Shabrios niros yofazulus, when people appear nice to another. She'ein ein beria b'chaver, the people are not miserly towards one another. Which means Rashi's learning like this. Yefos Marah doesn't mean that if you looked at them, they look nice. Yefos Marah is referring to the cows looking at the other cows. Yefos Marah, they all look kindly to the other cows. Very interesting, Rashi. They look kindly to the other cows, which means it has nothing to do with how the cows themselves appeared, but how this was, the cows were watching each other graze, and they were looking kindly at each other. And they were looking kindly at each other. This is the way Rashi translates this. And then Rashi seems to give us the coming attractions. What does this mean? This refers to the 7 years of abundance. Now, that's a little bit ridiculous for Rashi to do. The Torah goes to great length in some 20 sentences from here to explain to us what this means. What did Rashi need to foreshadow what the Torah is going to say very explicitly? 7 cows, 7 years of abundance. A very strange Rashi doesn't generally make a comment when the Torah, the whole purpose of the story is man had a dream, Pharaoh had a dream, he brings in interpreters, finally brings Joseph, who gives them the interpretation, and Rashi feels compelled to tell us the interpretation now. It doesn't make any sense. This is not the style of Rashi. It doesn't make any sense. He should do that. morning we're going to learn how to learn a Rashi, and it's very interesting. Okay, so that's the two questions were. Number one, Rashi changes what the simple translation that everybody who ever learned Chumash, whether you went to a traditional school, a right-wing school, a modern school, everybody always understood. Yafos Mara means the way the animals look. And Rashi says it has nothing to do with the way the animals, how they look, but whether the way they looked at each other. Let's go to Rashi's interpretation here. I mean Joseph's interpretation. Go to page 454. Sentence 25. You had two dreams, it's all one dream. The seven cows that are good cows are 7 years, and the seven stalks are good is also 7 years. One, it's just a repetition. The seven cows that are, emaciated, also 7 years. It's going to be 7 years of famine. Then Rashi says this, the seven, on sentence 29, sentence, behold, the 7 years that are coming are going to be years of sova gadol, great abundance. But we have 454, sentence 29. In all of the land of Egypt. That is an incorrect translation of the word. It'll be 7 years of abundance. The word in Hebrew for a lot is harbe. The word sova does not mean abundance. What does the word sova mean? Lachalta, you should eat the sovot and you'll be satisfied. Satiated. Satisfied. By the way, does anybody think that the word satisfaction and the word abundance are synonyms? Everybody knows those two ideas are not synonyms. A lot of people that have a huge amount of abundance have no sense of satisfaction. Sometimes people with a lot less do have satisfaction. They're not synonyms. Where does Joseph come to give such an absurd translation? Interpretation of the dream, and to say 7 years of satisfaction. Satisfaction doesn't relate to the amount of food. What does satisfaction relate to? The state of mind of the people. Where does he give this most ridiculous, by the way, let me ask a different question. What is it easier for God to do? 7 years of abundance or 7 years of satisfaction?
Abundance.
Abundance God does. Satisfaction relates to our free choice, our state of mind. In fact, I would think this is one of the greatest miracles of all time. That there are 7 years of satisfaction is an unbelievable miracle. But where does Joseph come to give such a wild interpretation? Put another way, how does a person know if they're satisfied? How are we supposed to figure out if we're satisfied? Well, I get a plate of food, or better yet, I live at the year's ending now. My debt didn't increase one iota. I had X amount of income, did not increase. I spent it all, and I didn't increase my debt by one iota. That doesn't necessarily mean I was satisfied. It could mean satisfaction. It could mean I'm fiscally responsible. I'm not satisfied, but I'd rather be a little unsatisfied and not owe any more money, right? It's no proof that I'm satisfied, the fact that I don't increase my debt. It just means I'm more concerned about my being fiscally responsible than I do about needing satisfaction. That could be. So there's no proof from the first, there's no proof from the fact that a person is fiscally responsible that he's satisfied. So how does a person know, to measure satisfaction?
When you look at your neighbor, you can't.
Well, we're going to see, one second. So there's one way of that I can determine I'm satisfied, which is probably a very good way of measuring satisfaction. If I leave over, I give away money. The person gives away money, then it's likely to be satisfied with what he has. That's very likely to be a good measuring rod for satisfaction. That's very likely to be. And we actually, tonight in the liturgy, the singing of the Zmiris, is one of the piyutim to go, Ochalnu, we ate, the Sovanu, we were sad, the Hosarnu, and we left over Kidvar Hashem, like God instructed. God did not instruct us to leave over. The most on Yontav, there's an idea of being on the Shabbos, owning, enjoyment, maybe satisfaction, but God did not command us to leave over. And yet the Pietan says, Ochalnu, we ate, the Sovanu, we were satisfied, the Hosarnu, and we left over Kidvar Hashem, like the Almighty has instructed. Probably what he's telling us is, God did not say that a person should leave over, but God said a person should be satisfied. Especially in Shabbos, it's owning the food, it's joy. Therefore, he's saying the litmus test to know whether you're satisfied is whether you leave over. Again, if you eat everything on the plate and you don't ask for doubles, maybe you don't have doubles. That itself is not a proof you're satisfied. You just make do with the amount of food you have. But if you leave over, Ochalnu v'Sovanu v'Hosarnu, we left over, then it's very likely to be that I'm satisfied. So that's one definition of satisfaction.
So the definition of satisfaction could potentially be shalom, peace, inner peace.
But how do you measure that?
We have to be so quantifiably tied.
What do you mean? I'm saying, but you need some way of measuring. My question is, what's the objective test? Because how do you know if you're satisfied? And if you're not satisfied, you should work on
internal peace.
How do you know if it has anything to do with satisfaction? And if you don't have internal peace, and be so, that means satisfied with what? Every single thing in your life as well? A person could not have internal peace, but he could be satisfied with himself fiscally. He could satisfy, or the very first, he could be satisfied with his marriage and his children. He doesn't have enough to eat or enough to live on. I mean, I'm talking about, how do you know in any particular area of satisfaction? Obviously, if everything in my life is perfect, it's something else. But we're not going to define satisfaction, everything in a person's life is perfect. We're talking about in any particular area. I mean, how does the person know if he's satisfied with what he's making? How does the person know if he's satisfied with what he has to spend and eat? That's what I'm asking. So one definition, if you leave over food or you give charity, that's one way of measuring satisfaction. Because if I was dissatisfied with the amount of money, it's not likely I would give it away. I'd be giving away money. In fact, I give away money. Ochalnu v'sovanu v'hosarnu, giving away. But here, there's another test. And this is the main idea here. And this test is, if I look kindly at my neighbor, if I don't begrudge somebody else, that's the definition of satisfaction. And let's go back to Rashi. Everything I'm saying is literally in the words of Rashi. Let's go back to the Rashi on page 448. Rashi says, there were seven cows, Yefos Mara. Now, Yefos Mara generally is translated, as Art Scroll itself does and everybody else ever learned it, Yefos Mara means the animals look good. That's not what Rashi translates. Yefos Mara, Rashi says, the animals were looking kindly at each other. They were not begrudging each other their eating, which means Rashi's learning that the seven cows here is not referring to the food supply in Egypt that's going to be during the 7 years. Rashi's learning it's referring to the people living during, it's referring to the Egyptians. That's the way Rashi's translating the sentence. The Egyptians during the 7 years will be satisfied. The seven cows are the seven, are the Egyptian people during those 7 years, not the food supply in Egypt. Let's now look at the Rashi inside. And you see, everything I said is really what was bothering. He's not giving us the coming attractions of the translation. Look what Rashi says. Yefos mar simen huli me sova. This is an indication for the days of Sova. I said, Rashi is giving us the coming attractions of the dream. No. Rashi is saying, this is a sim for Yemei HaSova, the days of satisfaction. Why did Yosef interject there would be satisfaction here? There's no place here that's talking about satisfaction. You're talking about plenty, abundance. You're talking about fat cows, healthy looking cows. Where is there any idea of satisfaction? Rashi's saying that Yosef calls these 7 years of satisfaction because the cows look kindly at each other. And the person doesn't look kindly at somebody else and needs the same thing that he does and not happy with somebody else's success unless you're a satisfied human being. It's a huge insight into human life. Your friend comes driving in your driveway next to your house, and his driveway drives up with a new Bugatti. See, Ralph, I learned from you. The new Bugatti, and I'm happy for it. That means I'm satisfied with the fact that I'm driving a Lexus. Because if I'm not happy driving a Lexus, I'm not satisfied, then I can't be happy for his success. It's a huge insight to human nature. The definition of happy, of satisfaction is, am I happy for somebody else's success? If you're happy for someone else's success, then you are a satisfied human being. And Rashi, where did Yosef pick up this Narish kite, this dream? That's the most incredible miracle of all. Not, I said, like making 7 years of abundance is nothing compared to what God had to create 7 years of satisfaction. That's a much harder miracle, much greater. Where did Yosef say? He should say there'd been 7 years of abundance. There's 7 years of famine, 7 years of abundance. Sova means satisfaction. They're not 7 years of satisfaction. Rashi says, because as you may, it says, Yefos Mara, that they are looking kindly at each other. That's where Yosef got it from. But now it even tells us another thing. This is just really teaches us how to read a Rashi. Rashi could have still waited till when the interpretation is given and explained it over there, right? The only thing is, when Joseph was told the dream by Pharaoh, this is all left out. Let's go and turn the page where Pharaoh tells him over his version of the dream. And he starts like this. On page 453, Pharaoh says to Yosef, in my dream I was standing on the banks of the river, that's sentence 17, and behold, from the river came out seven cows, brios busser, healthy cows, good grade A meat, yefos toar, and they have a very good form, and they're grazing ba'ochu, nothing at all about yefos mara. So Rashi can't, that would make no sense to say it here. Rashi's telling us that it was in what God showed to Pharaoh, not what Pharaoh gave over to Joseph's account, which means now we have a whole new understanding of the story. The fact that Joseph was able to give an interpretation not only based on what Pharaoh said, but on what the dream really was, was Pharaoh's proof that God actually gave Joseph the interpretation of the dream. And this is a man who has the wisdom of God. That's what Pharaoh says later on. Do we find a man he had great interpreters. And for one dream they can't interpret doesn't mean that, and he didn't say they all had great gifts of God, except this time they were stymied. They could interpret a dream that you could give over to somebody. You tell them what you dreamt, and they told you over. Here, you don't hear one understand what happened. Pharaoh gave over a version of the dream, but who did he interpret? He gave the interpretation of the dream that Pharaoh had seen. Rashi is giving us an enormous insight here. The dream of Sova has nothing to do with that which Pharaoh recounted to Joseph, but this has to do with what? What does this have to do with? It has to do with what God showed Pharaoh. which means that this has to be divinely inspired. There's probably a little hint in Pharaoh's thing also. Let's read the end of the sentence here. And sentence, page 448. And behold, from the river Olos came up seven cows, Yefos Marah. That does not appear at all. And Rashi says they were great, looking kindly at each other, which is now a new litmus test for satisfaction. Then it says like this. Fatir enu ba'ochel. No, it's only the second part. Brios bosa, there it was healthy looking meat. That's what he did tell her. Vatir enu ba'ochel. What does that mean? They were grazing in the swamp. Chazal say, the Medrash says, the word ba'ochel means ba'achva, in brotherhood. Very interesting language. They were grazing. Where else? Grazing is means where they're in, right? They're standing on the side of the, they're coming up the river, they're eating. The word ba'achu was totally unnecessary. They came up, they're grazing. Of course, they're grazing right where they just came up. Didn't say they traveled anywhere. Why did the Torah have to tell us ba'achu? So the rabbis say it's ba'achva, in brotherhood, which is, by the way, now an enormous definition of whether you are a good sibling with somebody. The definition of being a sibling. But this is a good message. I've got two brothers here that will help get this. The definition of a brother is somebody who looks kindly at the other one's success. Are you functioning as a brother? You know, to another human being, it's hard, but that's the litmus test for being a brother. A brother, a sibling, is someone who's kind, looks kindly at the success of their sibling. My siblings' kids are all got 4 years scholarship at Harvard. My kid's just about get into JC, into, you know, Miami Dade, or he's fabulously wealthy and I'm not. If I am happy with his success, then I am a brother. The definition of a brother is vatir enu ba'och. We have to be a fos mara, and they are grazing like brothers. Very fascinating definition of brother. I think most of us could probably work on that too. You know, it's a very difficult relationship. Somebody you grew up, slept in the same bed with, and all of a sudden they're fabulously successful or wealthy or famous, whatever it is, and or they have talents. To be happy with a brother's success is a huge test. But that's the definition of brotherhood. And by the way, by stranger, it can only be because I'm satisfied. By a brother can be because I am one with them. If you're one with them, there's also another way of being satisfied with somebody else's success, because we are one. So the Torah is defining here satisfaction. So there's one satisfaction: to a stranger, I look kindly. And grazing in brotherhood means if there's a feeling of oneness, then I also will be satisfied. That's what means to graze like brothers, means that I am happy with his success. He's eating more than me, has bet more. It's irrelevant. I'm happy with him. So the way a person is satisfied, the way a person can feel that towards a stranger is only if they're satisfied themselves. As long as you're not satisfied, you're not going to be able to be really happy with somebody else's success. But with a brother, somebody you feel one with, that's a possibility, even if there's a discrepancy. Now, obviously, the goal of every Jew is to feel a brotherhood with every single person, and every Jew, and therefore there's a responsibility or there's an ability, if you have that mindset, that you can be satisfied with their success.
Literally, the story is the relationship of the animals to each other, and then Rashi extrapolates it to the people.
Yeah, no, you know it's right. No, it's two things. It tells us the way they looked, healthy, had a lot of meat, as the Torah tells us here and later on, which means that there's going to be a lot of food. But the fact that the Torah adds Yefos Marah, that they were looking kindly at each other's grazing, means that it's also telling us what the state of mind will be of the Egyptians during the 7 years of feasting. Which, as I say, there's no way that anyone thinks that there's any corollary between satisfaction and having a lot. Many people have a lot, they're not satisfied. So it's an additional miracle here that God made, that not only would the people have a huge amount, they would also be satisfied.
Well, were the animals looking kindly because they could understand that there was enough for everybody?
I don't know. Even, is that enough for everybody? If I'm sad, England is enough for everybody. But you know,
I don't have to worry with my neighbors eating.
No, I. If I'm satisfied with what I'm having, look, we have three people, three brothers. The world is going to be divided in thirds. That's a pretty, you know, that includes Wall Street too and Manhattan too. But one man is unhappy. I'm only going to get a third of the world, and if he castrates his father, so there shouldn't be four children. You can have a huge amount, and you can have one third of the world. It's unbelievable. But you know, if this maybe reduced to a fourth or fifth, it's worthwhile to castrate my father. So satisfaction is not how much you have. It's also a state of mind. They were actually happy with what they were having, and they were and looked kindly at others, right? And the other, of course, thing here is a definition. That's what brothers are, too. But the Renu Boko, they grazed like brothers, which means we can all evaluate what our definition of brothers. This is an unbelievable miracle here that God made. God actually made people satisfied for 7 years. You know, we had big boom years here, but I don't know that there was a great deal of satisfaction. That's the message of this, what Yosef's saying. That's what Rashi's telling us. Rashi is bothered by which word? Sova. Now, he's not telling us, he's bothered where is the idea that Yosef says satisfaction come from. Sova doesn't mean satisfied. The answer is he sees it in the words Yefos Mara. That's what he tells us now. As he said it now, because when he gave over that in the dream, it wasn't there. The only allusion to that in the dream was Vatir Ener Ba'ochu. They were grazing like brothers. This, I say, comes out every Shabbos Chanuk. This is the most anti-Western civilization message. All Western culture is driven by competition. Anybody who's competing will never be satisfied. I mean, he'll be the gracious winner, but it's not real. And the loser, you know, come over and unless the coach can't, you know, control himself or he thinks that he's not going to be a telly and they won't catch him on this, he's disgusted at the fact that the other team won. He's sick that they beat him. The whole notion of Western civilization is driven by competition. This is the most anti-Torah value there is, because when you compete with somebody, you'll never be happy for their success. You can't possibly be happy for their success. You want to minimize their success. That's why the rabbis were so much against the Olympics. Not that, you know, Jews were always so anti-exercise and anti-health and had nothing to do with that, but a system based on giving a feeling of excellence because my bone structure is better, and because you can actually measure what a person, you can measure their bone structure and certainly know that I'm not winning any marathons. I'm not capable I won't have the bone structure for the discus no matter how much I exercise. And to create a system of competition, to measure competition, is a Western civilization culture, and it's anti-Torah. In the Torah, the only person you compete is against yourself. Are you reaching your potential? That's the only way you're allowed to set up a competition. And each person should be marked on what percentage of their potential they reach, not how they measure up against somebody else. So I said, this is Parshas Miketz, comes out every Shabbos Chanukah, and our victory over the Greeks was that actually we were able to overcome the insidious value system that became part of who we were, and this is probably one of the most important system values to get, and that is not to start measuring ourselves by competing, competition. Only am I reaching my potential. I'm making my effort. That's the only way. And without, because in a competition, there will never be satisfaction. There will never be a unified entity. I can't be happy with your success. Now, when I went to school, it's unbelievable. I don't know if it was the same thing here, but anybody knew you studied during finals in law school and you were in the lounge or something, you went out to get the bathroom, get a candy, your notes disappeared. I can tell you one thing for sure. I mean, these, of course, lawyers, these are people, the highest, you know, and the best students, the most moral people, of course. And a fascinating thing, everybody knows that you can't study. I couldn't even read my own notes, so I didn't have to worry about anybody stealing them. But it had nothing to do with that. No one's going to learn, but they could keep me down. And if they can keep somebody down, then their grade goes up. They didn't even benefit. The only benefit was to put me down, and therefore there's an indirect benefit to them. The curve changes. Had nothing to do with actually learning, actually benefiting. To learn something, nothing to do with that. That's what competition drives people to. I'm not talking about pay to hurt somebody, get a bonus because you could hurt somebody in football. And the real sickness of all competition is you think you can create a laboratory environment of actual, you know, we can really figure out who's better. You know, that's how ridiculous that is. Baseball. And we got, it's the perfect thing. Even if every umpire never made a mistake. But if the ball hits one place where the ground is a little harder than another place, it shoots over the head of the infielder and it's a hit. Does that make he's better? Because it happened. The ball happened to hit a harder part of the infield, or it hit a softer part, and then it changed its direction and it went through. You can't even create it. You're trying to create something which is so artificial, so false that it's not even accurate. Besides the sickness that it makes us rivals with each other, it's not even accurate. That's really very depressing. The end of the day, it's like gambling, like on anything else. It has nothing to do with anything that's real. They are a better team. It has nothing to do with being a better team, because there's so many variables that have nothing to do with skill. Nothing to do with skill. Wind all of a sudden comes and takes it out. Every day these happen. In every football game, in every baseball game, there's so many variables that have nothing to do with the player's skills that it's really a one huge joke to even think you can create a laboratory of better. But the real sickness is creating an inimical relationship between people instead of people being happy with the success of other people.
What does the Torah tell us about how to rule? So the Pharaoh gets this message. 7 years of abundance. Does he tell his press secretary, go out and tell the country that we're going to have 7 years of abundance and 7 years of famine? Or does he keep his mouth shut?
They know there's going to be 7 years of abundance because he sets up a whole system of increased taxation. So that they can use this as a resource to get themselves huge amounts of money. Because the first thing they turned it was against the people, but I don't think anybody had that feeling was going to happen. It would be to get money from outside, that he did. I don't know that he ever told them the 7 years of satisfaction. I don't know. But Yosef said it to them. People that were standing in the court were very smart people, the world-class wise people. So probably when you tell enough people, probably the word gets out.
Because it would seem to me that if that was going to be the plan for the next 7 years, you wouldn't want to tell the population, because they would be competing with, you know, what the state was trying to do.
Okay, maybe. It's hard to understand the whole. Pharaoh's not merely a king and a state. He's God in the eyes. So I'm not sure what he has to be able to live with people. Put it like this. No other country in the world today could get away. You're going to make, first of all, the state has a lot of money, but you have to give over your property, whatever you have. And after your property is out, we're not giving you food till you give us your land. I mean, there's a huge, that would be the basis, I think, a revolution in any civilized society today. And Pharaoh got away with that. The state has a lot of food, but give me all your money, all your movables, and your land. And your land.
And blame it on the Jew.
And but that, you know, that you need to be almost the deity to be able to get away with that. Something like the emperor in Japan before the Second World War. That doesn't go with, I don't think kings can get away with that, but it became religious. It was almost, so I don't know what he had to, it's a whole different idea when you're not thinking you're dealing with a king and you're dealing with a deity. So I'm not sure what he did. Let me just land one thing, because it's such an important, the Talmud says there are four things that a person always has to strengthen: learning, mitzvahs, prayer, and profession. That's why Rashi, Derech Eretz. Rashi says that means profession. In other words, you're an accountant. The rabbis say, we want you to work a little harder and smarter. You're a lawyer, you're a doctor. Or, all of a sudden, the rabbis are interested in making sure you have more professional success. They have more learning. That's a rabbinical message. More mitzvahs are rabbinical, better prayer. What kind of narishkeit? The rabbi, Arbat Srichim Chizuk, the rabbis are making sure that you. What they're saying is that the only way you'll ever be satisfied is you're working to your potential. If you're not working as to your potential, you're going to be unhappy, and you're going to resent other people's success. So that's a huge Jewish message to make sure to create unity. So it's one thing you have to do whatever you can do in avoda and mitzvahs and learning. But besides that, to be a functioning member of a unified society, everybody has to be working to their potential. You're working less than your potential, you're not going to be contributing to a unified society. You're going to be a cause of dissension and resentment and competition and begrudging people. So therefore, the rabbis consider just as important as the message is that you need to be mechazik in learning, you need to be mechazik in Yiddishkeit and mitzvahs, you also need to be mechazik in your professional success, because you need, not in your success, but in your efforts, because otherwise you're not going to be a happy person. So this is the Hanukkah message. It's always Parshas Miketz, and it's crept into our society so much. But I'll tell you one thing that at least I've done based on this. In our elementary school, met a few, maybe 8 or 10 years ago, with teachers, and said, we're going to have a whole new grading system. You know, it's a, not a small school, it's 500 kids, but in those days it was smaller. But in classes, like, we try to keep 15, 18, like 15. You have to try. We know all the students, they've been there many years. Find out from the last teacher, the last couple of years, try and grade the student according to their ability, not a standardized. I mean, can make a standardized test, but the mark is a boy who you think is working 100%, you give him an A. A boy is working at 50% will get a C, even if he gets a higher mark on the test. So that's a very, I think it's innovative. We've done it for years. We also wiped out that there's no competition, you know, in many places it used to be. Why us two, maybe 10 years, Mishnayos Baal Peh. The more Mishnayos you know by heart, the more you get a reward and recognition to knock that out. There's two boys. One of them has a terrific memory. It takes him an hour. He does 4 chapters of Mishnayos. Another boy does 4 Mishnahs, not 4 chapters. And one of them gets a message that he's brilliant. And one of them gets a message that he's retarded. That's a very unhealthy thing. You have to measure people according to their ability. So we really have implemented. That's a Torah value. To measure people against each other is a secular value, and it destroys people's self-esteem. It destroys a sense of unity in a community.